listeners for your continued support of your community radio station. If you haven't made your commitment to non-commercial community radio, you can still donate by browsing on over to our website, kboo.fm, and clicking on the tip jar. You are listening to KBOO Portland, the Mighty Boo, with Between the Covers coming up next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Fall 2014 Portland Debtors Assembly, taking place Thursday, October 30th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Center for Intercultural Organizing in Portland. Participants will learn about the debt system, listen to personal stories on how debt affects our daily lives, connect with groups working to redefine our funding priorities, and organize. Again, that's the Fall 2014 Portland Debtors Assembly, Thursday, October 30th, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Center for Intercultural Organizing, 700 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Mon Key, presenting roots rock duo Shovels and Rope Sunday, November 9th at the Crystal Ballroom. Shovels and Rope are touring behind their new album, Swimmin' Time. Tickets available now at CascadeTickets.com and at the Crystal Ballroom box office the night of the show.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program featuring interviews with authors of fiction and nonfiction. I'm your host this week, Leanne Kranz. Today, our guest is Roberto Trotta, a theoretical cosmologist and lecturer in astrophysics at Imperial College London. He is the author of the new book, The Edge of the Sky, All You Need to Know About the All There Is. He deconstructs the universe for us, using only the 1,000 most common words in the English language, and does so in 85 pages. The result is not only illuminating, but pure poetry. Planets become crazy stars. Galaxies are star clouds. The Milky Way is the white road, and the Earth is the home world. The Edge of the Sky is told from the point of view of a scientist, or student person, during her night observations through a, quote, big seer, one of the world's most powerful remote mountaintop telescopes, out of the reach of ever-encroaching light pollution. We are treated to passages like this. With the touch of a finger, she pushes the last red light, and with barely a noise, big seer opens his big eye. The light from the stars falls on her arm. Roberto Trotta answers the big questions that humans have pondered throughout our time on planet Earth and raises new ones. He interprets rarefied scientific language and brings the latest discoveries back down to Earth. It reads like a gift to humankind. Welcome, Roberto Trotta.
Thank you, Leanne. Great to be here.
Congratulations on this publication.
Oh, thank you. I'm very excited. This is my first book for the general public, and I'm really delighted to be able to put it out in the world, in the home world in this case, and I'm eager to hear people's reactions to it.
In the beginning of the book, The Edge of the Sky, you remind us that humans have been guided and governed by the night sky since the beginning, and people have been observing and mapping the sky and cultures all over the world. Can you describe the modern field of study known as cosmology?
Well, cosmology is the study of the biggest questions in the universe, or as I call it in the book, the all there is, because universe is not one of the words on a 1,000 words list that the book is written in. And so cosmology really asks some of the most fundamental questions about the universe. Where did it all come from? How did it come to be in the first place? And what is its fundamental nature? What are the mysterious dark matter and dark energy components that together make up almost the entirety of what is out there, and how will it end? So all of these big questions really are about our place in the cosmos, and why are we here, and why the universe looks the way it does. Those are the questions that are at the heart of modern cosmology. And the astonishing thing is that some of these questions we can even answer, but of course there are many more mysteries that come up all the time, and the more questions we answer, the more fresh questions we come up with.
What can you tell us? What things do you currently know that you cover in the book?
We know a fair amount of information about the universe. For example, we do know that the universe began in a hot, dense, highly energetic state 13.7 billion years ago. And that's astonishing to think that we know this for a fact, and we can even pinpoint down the birth date of the universe, if you like. And it has expanded ever since, and it's now being completely dominated by dark components. So one of the biggest mysteries of modern cosmology is, what is the 95% of the universe that we don't understand? The two big components of the universe, the dark matter and the dark energy, we call them like that simply for lack of a better names. We ourselves, we don't know what those things are, and we're trying to figure it all out. And one of the things that the book is about is precisely to recount the story of how we came to know certain things about the universe, and how we came to believe that most of what is out there is actually invisible, and what it means for the fundamental nature of reality. So the main character, the student woman who goes out to Big Sear, one of the biggest telescopes on Earth, to try and figure out what dark matter is made of, she asks those very same questions herself. And so we follow her during a night of observation as she tries to unlock the mystery of dark matter, and at the same time, thinks back to the long path that got us to this place in our knowledge.
Then let's get right to dark matter and dark energy. This is one of the things we, quote, don't know, but you know a lot about it, and it has an interesting history. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, the dark matter mystery is one that's been with us for 70 years now. And in fact, perhaps the best way of talking about it might be to talk about it using the very same words that our student woman uses as she thinks about this very mystery. So here is how the dark matter mystery and the puzzle of the dark side of the universe is recounted in the book. It seems crazy that student people should think that there is a lot more stuff that you can't see than stuff that you can see. Student people being scientists, of course, scientists not being one of the words that I could use, so scientists have become student people. Still, they do. In fact, they believe that there is about 5 times more dark matter than normal matter. If you look around us with a far seer, you will realize that the white road is made of many, many stars. There are about 4 times 10 stars in a white road for each person on our home world. And if you use a big seer, this is a big brother to the far seer, you will find that there are as many other star crowds in the sky as there are stars in the white road. And yet, all of this is just a tiny bit of everything there is. So that is the fundamental question about dark matter. Why is dark matter so abundant in the universe, and yet we can't see it? Now, of course, you might ask, how do we know that it's out there in the first place if it's dark? And the fact is that although it's dark, it has a mass, and having a mass, it has an effect in terms of gravity. And so while we can't see the dark matter directly, we can see the gravitational effect that it has on all other particles, all other galaxies, that's to say star crowds, in the universe. And so we observe the way galaxies move and the way they are clustered together in the sky. Another phenomena that involve the shape of galaxy being distorted by dark matter. And this lets us conclude of the presence of something invisible, something that's doing all of this strange dance, if you like, in the sky. And that is how we know that something that we call dark matter, for lack of a better word, is out there. So this mystery has been around for 70 years now, but we may now be on the edge of actually cracking it. And so I believe that dark matter might be discovered on Earth in one of our labs within the next 5 years, if you're lucky.
Let's talk about that lab a little bit.
The official word is the Large Hadron Collider. But because it's such, this is one of those jargony words that we as scientists should not be using all the time if we want to communicate our science more clearly, which is what my book is about, then, you know, the Large Hadron Collider in my book becomes the big ring, because it's a ring in the ground, effectively, and it's one where particles are smashed together at high speed. And so instead of talking about particles, I talk about drops. Instead of talking about smashing them together, I talk about them kissing each other, because that's what they do, in a sense. And so this particle accelerator is one of the aims for which it was constructed, was to take particles and accelerate them at very high speed, giving them lots of energy. Now, Einstein told us that energy equals mass times c squared, where c is the speed of light. And so high energy means high mass. And so with all this energy packed together tightly into those particles, when they smash together, when they kiss each other, if you prefer, we can create new types of particles, very massive particles, if we have enough energy. And we hope to be able to create, in this way, some particles that could be the dark matter particle that's responsible for these strange gravitational effects that we see in the cosmos. So far, we haven't seen it. We've only created, and I say only in inverted commas here, we've only created the Higgs boson, the so-called God particle, the particle that's responsible for giving mass to all of the other particles. Mm-hmm. And that was a Nobel Prize worthy discovery, of course. But more is soon to come, and hopefully dark matter will be next.
5 years, wow. You mentioned dark matter. We haven't seen it yet, but in a sense, we feel it every day in our daily lives. You mentioned that we spend our lives sitting in dark matter rain, but we never get wet. Can you expound on that?
That's right. It's astonishing to think that in 1 second, if you extend your hand out, in 1 second, there is about 50 million dark matter particles going through your hand per second. And we don't really feel any of this. Those are invisible particles that just whiz through our bodies, the entire Earth, without being bothered by the presence of matter. But if our theories are correct and those particles really are out here in this very room, they will be detectable. They can be observed using the right instruments and the right machines. And so some of those instruments we have put deep into the ground at the bottom of caves and abandoned mines so that they are shielded by kilometers of rock above them from all other possible interferences that would spoil the quiet environment that they need to detect this mysterious dark matter, what I call the dark matter whispers, if you like. And so those experiments in the ground have not picked up yet a signal for dark matter, but they might do so in the next few years as they become more and more sensitive. And if they do, when they do, it will be a completely earth-shattering discovery. We will have detected a particle that's responsible for a quarter of what is out there in the universe, and yet that has never been seen before. And that will be a major, major breakthrough in our understanding of what the universe is really made of. Dark matter has a gravitational pull, just like normal matter, only it's much heavier than normal matter, perhaps 1,000 times as heavy as a proton, which is one of the components of normal matter. And so dark matter pulls things together, just like normal matter would, only there is much more of it in the universe, and so it's got a much stronger effect. The opposite of dark matter is what we call dark energy.
Okay, let's talk about dark energy.
Which in the book is called the dark push, because energy, of course, is not one of the words on the list. And it's called the dark push precisely because what it does to the universe, it's pushing the universe apart. It's making the universe expand faster with time. It's acting as a sort of anti-gravity of sorts. And it's making all the other star crowds around our own star crowd, namely the White Road, the Milky Way, it's making them fly away faster and faster from us until one day, far in the future, billions of years in the future, that we'll have disappeared and we will be left alone in this dark cosmos. So perhaps the best way of understanding the dark push is just to, again, listen to how our student woman thinks about it in the book. The student people already had a deep question to answer. What is dark matter made of? Now, they had two more questions. Where does the dark push come from? And why do the two together add up to 20 times more than the normal matter out there? One thing appears to be clear. If the dark push is what the dying stars say it is, then it will continue to push things away from each other. The bigger the old race becomes, the more empty space there will be, and the more dark push. This will make the old race grow even bigger, even faster, and so on for all time. You can't stop the dark push. All other star crowds will fly away from us faster and faster until at some point, far away in time, we won't be able to see them anymore. They will be too far away for their light to reach us. Stars will die, and the star crowds will turn off. The older rings will become even bigger and almost totally empty. Nothing will be left but dark silence. And that is the destiny that awaits us in a few billions years' time.
Yeah, that was a jaw-dropping chapter to read.
Oh, thank you.
At the end, yes. So what do astrophysicists think will happen to us floating in space? Billions, hopefully we're still here, billions and billions of years from now. What does that mean for life on Earth?
Well, we won't really see any of this happen, at least not unless we develop spacefaring capabilities, because way before the dark push will have pushed away everything outside our galaxy from us, what will happen is our sun will become a red giant. That's to say, it will expand and become much bigger than it is today, so big, in fact, that it will burn the Earth up, because it will become as big as the orbit of the Earth currently is. And so this will happen in the next 4 to 5 billion years, which is plenty of time into the future. But before, we have to worry about the dark push pushing things apart. We have to worry about the sun blowing up and burning us to death. So there's plenty of time to solve that problem, unless, of course, we manage to destroy our own home world in other ways, such as climate change, for example.
I know.
Earlier, which is a much more pressing concern, frankly.
Absolutely. We're speaking with Dr. Roberto Trotta, author of the new book, The Edge of the Sky, All You Need to Know About the All There Is. He uses the 1,000 most common words in the English language to explain the latest advancements in astrophysics to the rest of us. As I was reading your book, I kept thinking of something about the language, the poetry that you use to convey these huge concepts. I couldn't help but think about our myths in Western civilization and the creation stories of the indigenous peoples of the world, or the major religions of the earth. Humans have a history not only of asking these big questions, but also trying to convey that information to each other using simple, common language. What was it like for you?
I was very surprised to hear this voice emerge from the book itself. This is not something that I created, something that emerged naturally from this lexicon, this very Spartan lexicon that I had chosen to adopt. And so by adopting this poetic, if you like, straitjacket, this new voice emerged. It's not my voice necessarily, it's a voice that comes out of the format itself. So it's self-assembling in a sense. And it's you're right that in trying to convey these big, abstract, sometimes difficult concepts about the Big Bang and how it all came to be and what we know about it and what we don't know, trying to convey it using very simple words forces one to rethink them in a different ways, to put a fresh, new perspective on concepts that I thought I understood. But I understood them with certain words, and so not having those words forced me to think them anew, and hopefully the images that emerge from the book will be fresh and surprising for my readers as well. And I think you're right, the kind of language of this book is a language that it is in a sense prehistoric or mythical in a sense, because it's a language by which you would describe phenomena before you actually had the words for them.
Right, things that you can't really even describe.
That's right. Just try to put them in any words that you have without having perhaps the proper words, what we now think of as the proper words. But the one thing that I learned is that those words, those proper words, which are often jargony words, are actually stumbling blocks to understanding. More often than not, we, the scientists, we use those words thinking that the public at large will understand us. But that's not the case, simply because we have this many-layered understanding of these words, which is not something that everybody will have. And so by using technical or even just fairly specific words, we think we're being clear in our communication, but we're not. And so let's do away with these words. Let's use words that everybody can understand and see what kind of imagery, what kind of pictures emerge in people's minds. And this is my aim. If this is achieved, I'm very happy. And the aim of my book will be achieved, namely to not just talk to people's brains, but also to speak to their hearts, to put passion back into science.
Yay. This seems to be a personal mission of yours. I know you have another effort that you do in your Hands-On Universe project, where you attempt to do outreach and community engagement activities linked to the big questions in cosmology.
That's right. This is something I feel very strongly about, the engagement of the public at large, and especially people from disadvantaged sectors of society and young people who at school might not have the opportunity to being exposed to these big questions. And I think it's important for us as scientists, especially those of us who are engaged in fundamental research, research that's not immediately useful for everyday life and that frankly won't improve people's lives from one day to the next. It's important for us to engage the community, engage people at large, and explain to them why we need to be doing this research. Why is it important to understand the nature of the universe? And why should we spend taxpayers' money on it? Frankly, our jobs are funded from the taxpayers' pockets, and it's only fair and our duty as professional scientists to give something back to the people at large for the privilege of being able to have day jobs that involve pondering the big questions about the cosmos.
What do you personally hope to illuminate for humanity through your work?
Well, that might be a little bit of a tall order for humanity, but certainly for my readers. I do hope that the book will contribute to enthusing people for science. My point of view is that it is not difficult in this day and age to go out and find information about cosmology, about the Big Bang, and there are many excellent books and TV programs and all sorts of information on the internet about what we know, what we don't know in cosmology. But the point is that we first need to make people interested in the subject and reach out to a cross-section of society that is not made of the usual suspects, people who would usually come to an astronomy or astrophysics talk. Those are wonderful people, but it's like preaching to the converted in a sense. My mission, if you like, is to reach out to a bigger part of society and to share with them the excitement, the enthusiasm, the passion that is behind our science and the discoveries that we've made and the big puzzles that we still don't understand. And if I can reach even a little bit of this aim, I will be very pleased. And this book is an effort towards that aim.
Your book states that it's only a matter of time before we find another planet like Earth, but it's too far away to visit and we don't have the transport. Can you explain that concept, how it would be possible to have a counterpart somewhere out there?
For thousands of years, we have thought that Earth was at the center of the universe. Our ancestors put Earth at the very center of the cosmos. And then the Galilean Revolution told us that Earth is just a planet going around the sun, and the sun itself, we later discovered, is but one of 100 billion stars in our galaxy, the White Road, as I call it in the book. And modern cosmology has shown us that our galaxy is but one fairly meaningless galaxy in about 50 billion galaxies in the known universe. But one of the incredible discoveries of the last 15 years or so is that planets around other stars than the sun are also commonplace in the universe. We now think that about half of all the stars in our galaxy will have solar systems going around them. And in the last few years, we have discovered hundreds and now about 2,000 different planets going around other stars. All these planets that we discovered are very dissimilar from Earth. They are nothing like Earth. They look like Jupiter, like big gas giants, and often closer to their star than the Earth is to the sun. So that makes them not suitable for life because they're either too big or they're not rocky or they are too hot or they're too cold, etc. But with the new methods and telescopes that we now have at our disposal, we keep looking for planetary systems around other stars. And as our technology becomes better and better, we will be able to look for smaller and smaller planets at the right distance from their sun. And so one day, and this day could be just months or a few years in the future, the technology will become good enough that it will enable us to find a twin Earth orbiting another star, some light years away from us. So those distances are big enough that we have no hope of being able to cross them physically with any spacecraft, but we can pick up light signals from those distant planets. And with very sophisticated techniques, we can even tell whether telltale smoking gun signatures of life might exist on those planets. And so it's really only a question of time before we can answer the age-old question of, are we alone in the universe?
Fascinating. This book really did what you intended to do, I think, for me. Just the different images helped me see these concepts just from a different angle. And it really deepened my understanding, and it was very effective. And one thing I didn't expect, it was really funny. It was really entertaining as well, especially when you speak about your fellow student people, your fellow scientists, and what occurs when they get together and what they aspire to. If you don't mind, I would love to give folks a taste of your humor.
I think it's important to lift the curtain and ensure that student people are just normal people, and sometimes scientists get a little bit put on a pedestal in our society. But we're just normal people with shortcomings and problems like everybody else. So when a student person finds a good answer to a hard question, the other student people will gasp, hug each other, and then throw a party. Those parties never last long, for student people are in a hurry to go back to work and find new answers. The best party for student people is one that takes place every year in a cold place with lots of ice water, close to the top end of our home world. It is named after the person who set it up over 100 years ago, Mr. Nobel. All student people would like to be asked to go to this party, but only up to 3 can go together each year.
Hilarious. Well done.
Thank you.
So how can people find out more about you?
So one thing that I'm very keen about is to hear from my readers, because this book is very much experimental. It's half communication of science and half linguistic experiment, if you like, because of its unusual language. And so, and the book is very young, it's been published only a week ago. And so it's very much trying to find its readership and to fall into the hands of people who will appreciate it or like it or not. I'm very, very keen to hear from my readers what worked for them, and whether those new images about the universe clicked into place in their minds and especially in their hearts. And so I would love to hear from my readers via Twitter. My Twitter username is @r_trotta, or more simply via my webpage, www.robertotrotta.com, where my readers can also find a specially designed comment box, which is limited to the 1,000 words language. And so if they want to put their thoughts in the 1,000 words format and try it out for themselves, how easy or how hard, it's quite hard, actually, it is to write to the 1,000 words format. I'd be delighted to hear from them.
And Roberto Trotta. Trotta is spelled T-R-O-T-T-A. RobertoTrotta.com. Well, thank you, Roberto Trotta, for being our guest. You're a beautiful writer, and I really enjoyed your book.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much for having me here.
As I was reading, and frankly during this interview, I felt my mind expand like the galaxy. It's really thought-provoking, and I can't wait to share this book with my nephews.
Great, and I hope your nephews will like it very much.
You've been listening to Between the Covers on KBOO. Thank you for listening and supporting KBOO during our membership drive. I'm Leanne Kranz. Our guest once again, Dr. Roberto Trotta, his book, The Edge of the Sky, All You Need to Know About the All There Is, by Basic Books. Thank you. And KBOO has a copy of this book to give away to the first caller at KBOO's main number, 503-231-8032. That's 503-231-8032. Good luck.
Hey, fellow weirdo. This is Rich, host of Radio Lost and Found. Be sure to check out the show in its new time slot. That's every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight. Radio Lost and Found is a 2-hour media scape of found records, tapes, found sound, internet insanity, and more. That's Radio Lost and Found every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
Hey, weirdo! Come out and play!
Everybody run, run, run.
Yeah.
Everybody scatter, scatter.
Yeah.
Some people lost some bread.
Yeah.
Someone nearly died.
Yeah.
Someone just died.
Yeah.
Police, they come, army, they come.
Yeah.
Confusion everywhere.
Yeah.
7 minutes later, all don't cool down, brother. Police don't go away.
And hello. Those are the great sounds of the great Nigerian musician Fela Kuti, a song called Blood, Sorrow, and Tears. And we're going to be talking about him with a man who portrayed him for many years on Broadway, Sar Ngauja, who's on the phone with us from New York, I believe. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Good
how
morning.
Are you doing, Portland?
I'm doing pretty well. Yourself?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. Yeah, hiya. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing well. I wanted to mention that actually Fela Kuti would have been 76 years old just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Just had the annual Fela Bration party that takes place, in cities all over the world where they're acquainted with Fela. And, of course, in Nigeria, at the New Africa Shrine, they have a massive celebration that goes on for that entire week. Thousands of people visiting from all over the world, a lot of great bands and all of that. Yeah, so Baba 76, as we call him right now, 76 years old. Yeah.
So have you always been? Have you long been a fan of Fela?